Amen. I hope this is making more sense and it's starting to become clear, okay? And this will be subtitled, these parts, What is the Good News? So that if you want to just play that, those parts again, or maybe refer somebody to listen to in case somebody asks, it'll be part of the bigger teaching, but at least you'll see them as you do with the good news. And I think all of the parts also are also saying they had to do with the armor. So I don't know how many subtitles we can stick on anything, but it's still part of the armor as well, which we started, I don't know, 3 or 4 parts ago. All right. This is the afterburn. Okay, so if you want to come on up and ask a question, make a comment, share some thoughts. If you're online, you can start typing them in. Our Shamash team will make note of that, and then they'll get on the mic and read some of them over the mic, and I'll address as many as I can. Okay, unfortunately, so much of today went long, and so we don't have a whole lot of time, so we want to take some quick ones from you guys and hopefully squeeze a few in and get moving here. Okay, Steve, start us off.
Just a quick comment from what I got out of what you said today, is that the good news is not like a box of chocolates, the way we like to live our life, because we like to choose what we like. We can't only take what we like out of it. It's an all or nothing decision, because the more you give of yourself, the more you can become of him.
Amen.
And if you only go halfway, the halfway will end you. You won't get to the end you want to be at.
There you go. And I'd like to tell you that, honestly, I paid any attention after you said chocolate, but I didn't. I mean, you lost me at chocolate. I was just... No, that was a really good comment. Thank you. All right, Janet?
Rabbi, I just wanted to get excited about what you said. I think it was at the end of the teaching when you said that how whatever is written here, you can see it applied in your life and it playing it out in your life, even though it was written so many years ago. And so when you were reading about Isaiah and at the end of that chapter 54, I'm sorry, 52, when it said that they have, for they shall see, and what they had not heard, they shall understand. And then you were talking about how he keeps revealing to us, things to us, that whenever we found him to eye, we were given some, but as we made a decision to move here, in the last couple of years that we've been here, there's been so much more revelation. And I so much appreciate you, Rabbi, because we move here to have a community and we have our family, but being closer to you, meaning not closer in relation, which we love you, but I mean me being closer to your teaching that is coming from him, and the exhortation is what is really stretching us and growing us and helping us see more of him. Because I have heard, it's just so amazing how many times you say that, and it's true. I hear what you say, but I need to hear it so many more times for me to really see it and receive it and do something with the possession and do something with it. So I appreciate you, Rabbi, very much. And the other thing that I wanted to say is about Nahum.
Actually, hold on. Once upon a time, there was a lady, was part of the congregation. I can't remember her name off the top of my head, but she said that one of the things that she did was she always listened to the teachings at least 3 times, because the first time it had to penetrate through that self-sovereign voice. The second time it had to get past Hasatan's voice. And the third time she could actually hear Yahweh's voice. Okay? Because you have those other ones trying to make noise while you're not, to distract you while you're not paying. So 3 times it was what she was saying, at least, is what are the ways she went about it. So it's just an interesting thought. Go ahead.
With Nahum, Rabbi, I love what you said. He's not like he's bipolar, because he's talking about jealous, revenger, and all right. That stuff. But then he says, Yahweh's good, and he's your stronghold. And that's exactly what I was telling Miss Shira. Miss Shira and I like to talk all the time, and it's so fun because when you see, heart to heart, eye to eye, what is written, and I told her this. I said, I was raised in a very authoritative household. I was taught respect for my parents. My dad was very strict with us, and I knew about punishment or discipline, but I didn't know about rebuking with compassion, which is what you do, which is so cool. And so it's exactly what it's talked about here, how he can be compassionate. At the same time, he can be so, he can tell us where we are short. And I just appreciate you.
Awesome.
Thank you.
Awesome. All right, Craig?
You had started by, and every year this time, you give the same warning about Christmas and about not picking on our relatives and stuff like that, but we're not to be friendly with it either, are we?
No, no, I'm not saying that we should be participating in anything. I'm saying but we should not be in, you know, mocking, judging, criticizing what others are doing, because they're doing only what they understand.
Sure.
Okay? But you should not be participating in any of it. I just don't think that it shows Yeshua-like character for us to be posting what we think are little funny memes, you know, mocking and ridiculing people that are doing these things, because it just doesn't shed a good light on Yeshua when we act like that. We know that we don't need to be participating in those things, so we don't. They don't know, so they do. Our job is to just not participate in it.
Absolutely. That's okay. Why, like, yeah. I wouldn't go over to, say, my mom's house if she had a tree up at all. Wouldn't step foot in her house. She knows that it's not a deal, but once that tree goes up, you know, I'm not going to have a, you know, there's no interaction with me at that point in time, which I think...
Well, it's the idea of being set apart. You can be set apart, and that may not be received very well by someone. The thing is, you don't need to try to get them to be set apart.
Sure, I have no control over them or what they do, but I just want to make sure we all get a crew. We're not to be friendly with it either, that we're...
No, you're not going to be... You know, a judge and adversary to it, but you're not going to embrace it in any way or endorse it or support it. Okay? Simply, hey, that's your thing. You're welcome to go do that. I'm not doing that. Okay?
And then my second kind of idea, what you're talking about, the good news is that during Yeshua's time and even up till today, a lot of our choice is to decide actually what is the good news. Like, what are we going to follow? Rome, and I think it was Caesar at the time, had a very good news. Like, they brought peace and shalom, and his good news was, it was pretty enticing what they did for, you know, I'm not a historian, I don't exactly recall what their motto was, but they had a motto to it in the whole nine yards, and I think a lot of that, having the actual truth of what the gospel is going to help us to discern the worldly good news from what the actual good news is. And I really think we all need to to really be on point.
Good. Thank you for sharing that. Okay, Michael? And thank you guys for all being relatively quick here so we can squeeze some of the live stream in also.
This is a very comforting teaching to me today, Rabbi, so I wanted to praise the Father for giving you that, and I wanted to thank you for having this Hina Ni attitude to come up here every week, every service, and say things that, you know, people denigrate you online for. And I know they do it because we hear about it from time to time. But when we're talking about this, the good news, you know, especially when we were reading here in Mark about the, you know, the one matter you lack, go and sell all your possessions, you know. So this seems to be a preference issue. And, you know, you say from time to time about people who sit in council, oh, I just want to please the Father. I just want to please the Father. Well, the Father doesn't care about everything that you have, but he cares about some things. And the fact that you have a preferential conflict of interest means that you need to adjust your preferences. So if your preferences are truly towards him, then you can embrace the fact that there's some stuff that he really just doesn't care about, and there's stuff that he does care about that you're probably getting wrong anyway. I know I am anyway. But as far as, like, in my own life, this was very impactful to me because it helps me to see that as long as I'm walking this out, that I've got company in the right places. And some of that company is here, and some of that company is in the heavens, working, as they have been for the last 6,000 years, to try to give us the perfect place to live in the end of days. But the reason that that's been on my mind is because, you know, it's part of what has built what I gave my praise and prayer about this earlier this afternoon, is the way that I was raised was a very strict way, you know, that I didn't adhere to in my youth. And I remember my father telling me, even when I was a young man, grown out of his house and everything, but he had told me, you know, you're never going to amount to anything if you don't go to school. You can't hold a professional paying job if you don't go to school and get a degree. You'll be the only kid in this family that doesn't have a degree. Everybody else has a degree. All your cousins have a degree. You need a degree. And I said, Dad, I don't know about that. You just paid a guy $900 to install a couple bifold doors and fix a threshold in a door, you know. And I remember, too, when I was a little boy, my mom would say things like, you have to work hard and study in school. You don't want to be the guy riding on the back of the garbage truck. Do you have any idea how disappointed she was in me when I called her and told her, Mom, I got a job. I'm the guy loading the garbage truck. True story, by the way. Yes, I've done that job.
Oh, those guys, depending on where you live, they get paid pretty good, too. All right. Pete.
Rabbi, I want to get back to Mark 8. What struck me there was that Kefa had just called Yeshua the Messiah, and then three verses later, in the middle of Yeshua teaching, he pulls him off to the side. And what caught me is in verse 33, where Yeshua turns around and seeing his taught ones, which tells me that Kefa had put himself in a superior position to Yeshua, because Yeshua is turning around and seeing his taught ones, and then rebukes Kefa and tells him to get behind him, which is telling him, look, you need to be following me, not being in front of me telling me how to do my business. And I think that's, and then he really calls Kefa out, where he says, whoever desires to come after me, let him deny himself, which Kefa had not done, and take up his stake and follow me. Now, also, a stake also marks boundaries. And I think that goes in line with what he told the guy before, that he needed to sell his possessions. We use stakes to mark our property, to mark what's ours. And if we take those things up, we are giving all that up. But okay. I think Kefa was out of line. I think he got called out.
Oh, he was out of line. And, you know, I'm glad you brought it up, because more clarity from the verse. It talks about, you know, then Kefa taking him aside. Isn't that something that the person in authority does with the person that's underneath? Is they take them aside. And some of you would want to take one of the leaders aside. Some of you wives want to take your husbands aside. Sometimes it's a disrespectful positioning of authority, okay? There's ways to approach, but this idea of like, come here, and you call somebody over to the side. I need to straighten you out on something, okay? And some of you know what that look looks like, because somebody looks at you and says, come over here. That's when you're being taken aside. But now, notice something, though. Where is Kefa's complete meltdown and just running away and quitting because Yeshua called him Satan, called him an adversary? See, Kefa didn't do that, but a lot of you would. He just called me an adversary, and I was just trying to help, and I was just... But you were wrong. Kefa doesn't argue. Yeshua just says, let me straighten you out, and then go your way. Okay, sit down, shut up, and straighten it out. But this is, you know, because some people are like, oh, why can't you be more Messiah-like? I don't know. Messiah, look at how he rebuked somebody. Okay? But then you guys are all mad at me if I rebuke you at all. Especially when you overstep your bounds and you try to come over to me. I told this story many times. I had a lady in the congregation. We had changed the way we were doing the Vishamru to a different tune, so to speak, the canting of it. She didn't like it. And quite frankly, I didn't like it either. I was just trying a different option and, you know, seeing how that would work out. And she sat next to me during the oneg, and she looked at me, she said, Rabbi, she goes, you need to change that way we do the Vishamru back. I said, to whatever her name was, I said, first of all, you need to not talk to me that way. Okay, you don't tell me, especially in that tone, what I need to do. I said, I do agree with you. And I'm probably going to change it back because I don't really like it that way either. Just trying it, seeing how it played out. There was two very common ways to do it, and we were switching. I said, but you don't get to talk to me that way. And that wasn't because I'm all full of myself. I can't allow, for her sake, to think that it's okay to talk to an authority in that manner, which is very much like what you see Kefa doing right here. Because Kefa goes to Yeshua, hey, you need to not be doing that. Don't talk like that. Don't say those things are going to happen. And so she kind of looked at me. I was like, And I didn't get angry at all. I just said, first of all, you do not need to talk to me like that. Okay? And then I calmed it back down. I said, look, I agree with you, and I'm probably going to change it, but don't do that again. That's not respectful. Okay? You can come up to me and say, Rabbi, I see that we changed something, and I just want to share with you that I liked it better the other way. That's not what she said, though. She said, you need to change it back. I said, I don't need to do anything. Okay? And so, but see, you get rebuked. How do you react? We don't see Peter's reaction here, but how do you react? Do you fold and quit and go and tell everybody how mean I was or mean some authority was, whoever it was that was talking to you? Or do you sit back and realize, I put my foot in my mouth and I should not have stepped over those boundaries I shouldn't have stepped over and I should have behaved in a different way and I was wrong. But that takes a huge level of humility to recognize that you're wrong. Because you're so busy. See, this is really the problem. It's, we'll go in like in an order of things. You do something, okay, or something happens, you respond to it, then the person responds to you in a way that hurts your feelings, it makes you upset or embarrasses you or some other thing. From that moment forward, you forget that you did the thing that caused that. You're just mad now that they did what they did. And I usually have to sit there and go, but did it happen in a vacuum? Did the person just come over and rebuke you? Well, no. Well, what happened before that? Well, I jumped in where I didn't belong. And that's not what they're going to say, though. You have to remember that there is cause and effect. If you don't like the effect, you may want to think about, did you do something to cause the effect? Well, you know, my husband yells at me. Well, he shouldn't. But do you do anything to stimulate that? It may take two to make that mess. Okay? But people often have a problem. It's time warping in their head weird. As soon as the adverse thing happens to you, you forget that you actually did anything first that brought that about. You know? And I've had people say to me in my life, well, I'm all upset. Why are you upset? Because you yelled at me. I said, well, why did I yell at you? I don't know. You just yelled at me. Okay. I just walked in the room and started yelling at you for no reason. Let me refresh your memory. This happened. You responded where you didn't belong and inserted yourself, and then you got corrected for it. But you can't receive it at that point because now you're just too mad and upset. This happens every day in many of your lives, okay? In some relationships that you're in. And then you just seem to not want to have the reality of letting it play back. It's almost like we could wish we could play an instant replay. Let's see how this played out. And then you might learn to own your part in it. That doesn't mean it then justifies the reaction of the person who popped their cork or whatever. I'm just saying is you still have to at least own your part. Okay? And Kifa doesn't argue or say anything here. He's just like, okay. He realized I overstepped. And he got his wrist slapped real hard. Okay? All right, Gerardo.
Yes, sir. Mark 10, until when you finish reading. You've touched on this a little bit before in a different way for a different teaching. And then this one's a little different for this one, but they kind of go hand in hand. So I'm trying to figure out the fine line in between what it is that you talk about. Because, see, I don't covet work. I'm sorry, I don't covet wealth, but I covet work because work is going to give me the wealth and it's my ADD. So there's something that I do covet, but I know that there's a fine balance that's not balanced. That's an offset. Kind of goes to how do you tone it down, whatnot, and so how do you get to the point where you're actually able to, and I mean, I have a few ideas, but that's not for me to have ideas on. What is the middle ground to being,
all right,
seek him to get,
okay, right. Good question. All right, so look, it's the end result that's what is the issue, okay? If wealth is the end result, that's the problem, okay? If wanting work and being focused on work, and that's like a strong, you know, driving force because you want the wealth, because you want to take care of your family, because you want to give more to take care of and be more generous and all that, then there's an end goal that's not the work, okay? The workaholics that love their job, love their work at the expense of their families because it's about the work and that's their end is the work. So there's nothing wrong with being driven and being focused and having a really great work ethic and going out there and working, as long as the working is towards a greater purpose, okay? But if the work is the purpose, and that's your obsession and focus, then we have a balance problem, okay? Because the work is there to be a means to something, okay? It's not the end in itself. It has to be a means to something, all right? Okay, Brian?
Just a quick comment. An occurring theme that I saw in a couple of these examples is something you talk about a lot, and it really stuck out to me, especially when we're dealing with the man that asks Yeshua, what do I need to do to inherit eternal life? And him and having issues with dealing with losing material things. But also, I see the same problem with Kepha. And we have this innate ability to not live in reality. You talk about that a lot, right? If Kepha was living in reality, the fact of the matter is he was standing next to Messiah, who could call down a legion of angels if he chose to. But the fact is that Yeshua trusted the Father because it was the Father's plan, so he didn't do anything. And because Kepha temporarily stepped out of reality into emotion and usurped that, that's why he got the smack on the wrist. The other gentleman that was asking Yeshua how to inherit eternal life, every single day we can choose to uphold covenant, right? We have all of these amazing reasons to do the covenant. We have a golden ticket, so to speak, right? Like I think about, you know, Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory or something like that, right? Everybody, like Uncle Joe jumps out of bed after 20 years because he gets a golden ticket to go to a chocolate factory. Here we are with the scriptures where the creator of all things comes to us and says, here's your golden ticket, obey. And why aren't we as excited to jump up and do that, to live with him forever? Because, and I'm speaking about myself too, we have this innate ability to fall out of reality and live life with blinders, but we need to be focused on him and staying within that reality and doing what he asks us to do.
Amen. All right, well, also think about when you compare, I think it's a good comparison, this golden ticket Willy Wonka thing. Look, Grandpa Joe jumped out of the bed because he wanted to see the factory, and he wanted to go to it. So it wasn't anything that he had to do, okay, except just get up and go. So it'd be like if I said, hey, here's your ticket, come into the kingdom. You'd jump right up and go. But he's saying is, no, you have to do the work first to get the golden ticket. Like all the other people who worked at it, they were buying millions of bars and they were doing whatever they had to do to try to get this golden ticket. You've got to do the walking and the work. And some of that is going to go against, it's going to be an adversary with your preferences. And that's where the challenge is going to come up. There wasn't anything to challenge Grandpa Joe to get up, except he had to just get out of the bed, okay? But preferences, okay, is always going to be a weighting of which do you want more? He wanted to stay in the bed, but he wanted to go to the factory. So which do you want more? Well, obviously the factory jumped out right out of the bed. Whatever you're suffering inertia from, in other words, you're struggling to do, well, guess what? If you wanted it bad enough, you wouldn't struggle at all. How many of you have heard this sort of play out in your house? Your child, you have to pull them screaming out of the bed to get them to get up, to go to school and whatever. But the day that you're going to the amusement park, they're already in the car before you wake up. And you're amazed how they manage to get up by themselves, get dressed and get ready that early in the morning. Because they wanted something. And they didn't want the other. You don't rush and run and get excited about what you're not excited about. And so as Brian was pointing out, we should be getting excited about these things. And then we'd overcome the inertia. We'd go and run and go get it and get it done. You know, some of you need to change jobs, get a second job, whatever, but you're not excited about it. Get excited about it, you'll go get it done. Anything that you get excited about, you'll find a way to get it done. That's the way it always is. You can ask a busy person, if you give them something they really want, they'll find a way to squeeze it in. So don't give me the excuse I'm too busy. You always make room for what you want to do. Isn't that true? Let's be honest. Okay, Stephanie?
Thank you. I really appreciated this journey through looking at the good news, because it was part of my journey even coming into this understanding, because it's what helped me to see what blindness was in the church. Because when I asked the question at a study about what good news could Yeshua have been referring to, when, and you pointed it out in the Mark passage, when he says, you know, I'm going to go, I'm going to die. And, you know, they're pulling him aside going, say it ain't so. No, of course you're not going to die. And then there are other places in the Gospels where it talks about Yeshua sending out 70 to spread the good news. That couldn't have been the good news because none of them believed it. Why would he send 70 people out to say something that they didn't believe? So they couldn't have been going out and telling him he's going to die and resurrect, and that couldn't be the only good news that was being referred to. So I enjoyed this.
You're welcome. And a very important point is the church will never seem to address is that they weren't going to share any news. They were sharing news that was being waited on, anticipated, looked for, okay? And that's not being taught by any of them. He didn't just send them out with this new great information. He sent them out to share information they'd been waiting for, looking forward to, because that's what we read in the Tanakh. That's really the key that they're never going to tell you.
And since you're teaching on the being set apart, you said, when we were reading the Nahum passage, you said, you talked about the fact that, because it says it was who brings good news, who proclaims peace, you talked about them bringing peace between you and Yahweh. And it reminded me of Pinchas, who was given a covenant of peace for going in and really taking things out of the holy place that needed to not be done in the holy place, so defending him. And it makes me think about the fact that I think that especially this idea of peace gets really convoluted in today's society with the kind of that Zen idea, like it's all just sit quietly and be calm. Whereas even the Pinchas thing and some of what we see in these is giving us an indication that the peace isn't always about just being quiet and calm. And I know that the idea of peace and shalom, it's where I right. would love an additional teaching from you further on that whole concept of shalom and what it is, because I don't think it's always fully that Zen quiet idea. Some of it is very much of a pull people up, talk to them firmly, get them to understand, stop them short. It's not always feeling quiet and calm and peaceful. It's sometimes a really shocking thing, but I can appreciate how seeing that, and it, when you made that connection, I thought of Pinchas. It's like, oh, and that's how we get to be set apart, is you have to sometimes shock us into that, kind of bring us up quickly with a firm word.
Awesome. Okay, thank you. Okay, Olivia?
Okay, so in Mark 10, you were talking about how, like, the guy, he was asking Yeshua, like, oh, how do I, like, get, like, eternal life? And he explained everything, of course. And then you made, like, the analogy, like, when he said, take up the plank, and then your new, like, interpretation, you said, dedicate your life to fixing the plank in your own eye. And you probably, like, explained this before, but I'm just a little confused. Like, how do you figure out what your plank is, and how do you fix it?
All right. That's a good question. I really like that. Okay. If only I had a good answer to go with it. Look, it's very, very challenging, okay, for you to see the plank in your own eye. What you have to do is you have to have close friends, family, counsel to help you, you know, when you're going through something, that's where they can point it out. It's not like they can just go and say, can you tell me what planks you see in my eye? No, that's not the way it works. But as you're going through certain things and you struggle, actually, it's when you struggle, you may be realizing, you know what, that may be something that's making me blinded so I can't really see the situation, right? Because a plank in your eye is something that makes it hard to see, okay? So you don't see things right in relationship, or you don't see things right in some other situations, and that is a plank. It's not so much the stumbling blocks and all the sin and all that. It's your inability to see things correctly. This young man couldn't see things correctly. He couldn't see that he had a problem loving his possessions over following Yeshua. Okay? And so it's something that if I put a plank in your eye, it would hinder your ability to see. So what things are going on in your life, usually it's an emotional thing, it's a preferential thing that makes it hard for you to see or receive what you need to see and receive. Okay? All right, live stream.
You commented about the boundary marker. The state could have been the boundary.
I didn't actually. Okay. Did.
Lee Blue says, Rabbi, in my line of work, a stake is always used as some type of boundary marker. Would it make sense to pick up your quote-unquote boundaries, all that you are bound by, and follow me?
That could work.
Justin Snyder, Mark 8:33, could Yeshua say, and get behind me also be taken as him telling Kepha to get behind him and follow him, to trust him as the leader, submit to his authority and plan by following him?
Okay, that could work.
Monica DeLeon said, Rabbi, thanks for the teaching. Would our mental disposition be our stuff too, or as well? Again, I think she's saying as well. Only when we clean our stuff can we then grow and become givers.
Well, I think you can kind of do both at the same time, but you're going to be limited in your success when your stuff is more abundant and you haven't cleaned too much of it out. So I don't think you need to have it all cleaned out before. But I just feel like when you're making the effort to do and also the effort to clean out, that at some point the doing becomes much more productive as there's less stuff hindering. Okay? Next.
Rick Johnson, is first, last, and last first referring to a social status?
No. And you know what? And that verse needs a lot more explaining. But basically, it says, look, It's not about when you come into this. He says some of the first will be last, some of the last will be first. It has to do with what you do with it. Don't worry about those that have more time in this. Don't worry about if you've got less time in this or whatever it is. He says what's going to matter is what your choices are. And so some, even though they were receiving this before others, they may end up being last because they didn't do anything with it. And some, because they did a lot with it, are going to end up being first, even though they were later to the dance, so to speak, okay? All right, that was it?
That's it.
All right, fantastic. All right.